It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
An Eastern Shore activist turns into a political challenger. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Kirkland Hall has been a prominent activist and former president of the NAACP in Somerset County. Now he's decided to challenge two-term incumbent Republican Charles Otto for the 38A district seat in Maryland's House of Delegates. But the incumbent Republican has trounced two former Democratic challengers by nearly 2-1 margin. Well, this morning we have Kirkland in our studios, and welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, by the way, before we get started with the local material, what is your own reaction to the events that unfolded in Las Vegas?
I think it's so sad and tragic that our country has become so violent, and people, for some reason, whether mentally ill or hatred for mankind, have succumbed to such atrocity of just killing people random that you don't know for and virtually no reason. And I just feel for the families and the children of those who lost their parents. It's just sad for our country.
So turning to your bid to unseat Otto, as I mentioned a moment ago, he's won twice by a nearly 2-1 margin. What has made you decide to go ahead and turn once more from activist into political challenger?
Well, one of the things, although he is an incumbent, and I realize he's going to be a tough gentleman to beat. He defeated two other challengers, again, by a large margin. But I think I bring something different to the table. Based on my research, looking at Somerset County, it's still the poorest county in the state of Maryland. Worcester County, which is also covered, ranks number 11 in the county. However, after the Ocean City season, it ranks close to the bottom, just like Somerset. So I think some new ideas need to be brought forth on how to change the plight of our community people. And my goal would be to work to change the quality of life. Again, Somerset, been the poorest county in the state of Maryland for a number of years. That means that the motto of Somerset is Semper Idem, always the same. So now we've got to change that, because individuals are looking for some other way of living as opposed to hands out all the time, depending on social service, depending on handouts from churches and other groups. I think most people now want to be able to take care of their own families.
Well, because I was looking at it, I think Somerset County, which is a big chunk of the district that you're running in, has something like a 25% poverty rate. And I've talked to a number of people over the years with all kinds of ideas for economic development. We had one time a proposed ferry at one point for Crisfield. How do you change that? Is there something in the DNA of the Somerset County and part of Worcester County that just is not moving it forward? Why do we have this?
Well, I think you have to change the mindset of people. And what happens too many times, those in charge, those that are successful, are trying to make decisions for those that do not have. It's time to bring those individuals to the table and ask them what are their concerns. And once we get a nucleus of what their concerns are, then we develop a plan. We've been developing a plan before we talk to those that are at the bottom. For example, look at the educational system that we have. Is that system preparing our citizens for green jobs? Is that education preparing our children or youth to go into jobs of not only agriculture but in plumbing, refrigeration, air conditioning? Those areas, masonry, those are the areas that I think that we have left untapped, and why so many young children are left out in the cold. Everybody does not want to go to college. But we got Salisbury State. We've got Ward Community College. We've got UMES, three institutions, fine institutions of higher learning in our community. And we have not yet begun to tap that until this past year when Dr. Hoy at Ward Community College decided to give young children with 2-point average an opportunity to go to school tuition free. Not only the Ward Tech needs, but other schools need to come up with some kind of innovative ideas so that other individuals can at least go to school, develop a profession so they become employable. We have too many people that are just not employable in our county because of a number of reasons. And also because of that, we have a large drug problem. When people are left idle, home all day long, bored, nothing to do, we succumb to alcohol, cigarettes, and drugs, which is also a tremendous problem in our communities.
So, I mean, as a matter of fact, I remember a few years ago we were talking about the lack of representation, for instance, Somerset County, when it came to minority representation, particularly African-American representation. African-American community is something like in the 40% mark in terms of the people and the population there. And one of the things that was talked about was the fact that many of the kids that go to, for instance, a UMES, historically black college, they go there even from the area and then they leave. They just disappear, and that they cannot attract people not only into the private sector but into the public sector. What do you do about that, particularly as a delegate? I mean, is there some resistance to more money funding? Does it require more funding for an institution like UMES? What's the mechanism, you think?
Again, I think it's a mindset. Somerset for so long, and I'm quite sure parts of Worcester County, families tend to look out for family members. If there are jobs available, again, human nature, you can look up for your son or daughter or granddaughter. And if there's something left over, you look up for other people to ensure that you're following the laws of the land. But again, there are not too many employable opportunities. We got the prison. When the prison was first brought into the county, I was opposed to it because I knew what was going to happen. I knew when the prison was constructed, not only to provide jobs, you got to fill those beds. And based on tradition, those beds can be filled by the minority population. And that came into fruition. But after they get out of prison, then what did they do? The tables are stacked against them. If they got court fees, they got court fees. They got to pay support, they got to pay support. Whatever fee they didn't pay prior to going to prison, they've got to pay it. They get their salaries gone. So how can they buy a home? How can they rent a home? How can they get a car? How can they pay for insurance? How can they buy food? How can they pay utilities? So the debt is stacked against them. So now we have the prison. We've got to use that to our advantage. Now they're having difficulty even hiring correction officers. They're offering bonuses to get people to work. Again, another problem. So many people in our community have drug problems. So they're not going to qualify to work at the correction institution. So again, it's about looking at the mental state of people in our community. We've got to even start in schools, educating our kids about, I'm from the area, and I've had several job offers during my tenure at UMES, but I chose to stay. I chose to stay because I wanted to contribute something to the community and which raised me, which nurtured me, and I felt that I've done the best that I could. But now I decided to go in another direction.
Now, of course, obviously agriculture is a big industry in Somerset County, and particularly the poultry industry. And we've had in the recent years these large chicken houses that have been popping up and near residential areas that certainly are in the agricultural sector, in the agricultural designated areas, but nonetheless, people did not expect to see. Matter of fact, some of those people who object to them, I saw Trump for science in front of him. So this is not some kind of liberal or conservative. There's the people who are concerned about this. Where do you stand on these kinds of large chicken houses, particularly in relationship to where they are located? And is this just simply a matter of local zoning, or do you think a state legislature has something to offer here?
I think both. I think one thing we need to concern ourselves with smart growth. I would not want a poultry house next door to me. So I think the thing to do is, again, get everybody to the table. And we've got to mediate this situation. Work with the poultry industry, and the citizens. For example, a few years ago, I was able to bring a family that had been divided for over 70 years, the lynching of George Onwood. I, along with other individuals, able to bring the nephew and granddaughter of the elderly lady who said that George Onwood, African-American male, that accosted her to the table with his nephew. We had dinner. We talked. We talked the ways to mending and reconciling that particular situation. So the same thing needed to happen with the poultry industry. We realized they want to make money. We realized we live in a capitalist society. But we also, it's got to be even care. We got to make sure that our citizens can live in a place that they choose to stay without having to smell the poultry houses day in and day out. And the question I ask them all, would you want to build a chicken house close to your home? And we take that, we think about that, then we find those open areas where it's not populated by citizens and build them there as opposed to next to individual houses. And I love chicken.
Do you think that the poultry industry, I mean, it obviously has offered up some regulations which some of the people in Somerset County, for example, do not feel are adequate. Do you think that the poultry industry is being resistant to moving further than what they've done? I mean, and how they view these people, even though they're just the average resident?
Well, in the game of life, individuals in business are going to try to negotiate with local politicians, regulations and ordinances that satisfy what they're trying to do, where the citizen does not have an opportunity to lobby. And we know that they're going to donate funds to certain politicians who are going to favor their particular views. And that's where the imbalance falls in. And that's where it's not fair to the local citizenry that lives in that community. Because all they can do is protest. They protest, they protest, they protest. And yet, it's politicians who design the ordinances who make the final decisions.
The way, how do you balance, for instance, concern for the environment and say not only agriculture but also the watermen? Because there's this conflict that seems to be set up between trying to preserve the environment and even clean up the bay on the one hand, and on the other hand, there seems to be some resistance, certainly in a part of agriculture, but also watermen saying, "Well, wait a minute, we're not necessarily the problem." And there seems a real struggle between those two poles. How do you bridge that gap?
Okay. The only way is discussion. Everybody, the leaders of the watermen, farmers, poultry, and citizens need to be brought to a round table. Every year they have a meet in Ocean City of all the local officials. Again, I don't know what gets done. They've never been there. I don't know what problems they solve. But they're spending money.
Okay.
I don't know what problems they solve. However, we need to do the same thing with people that are impacted by the pollution.
Do you think though, that both sides have become so entrenched that you can't bridge that gap? I mean, I hear a tremendous resistance saying, we're not the problem, or, you know, that you're taking my livelihood away. And obviously environmentalists say, well, no, but I've got these studies. And then we get this conflict about one study as opposed to another study. I mean, it seems to me that divide is deeply, deeply dug.
Well, again, I think that's the mindset of the populace. When someone feels threatened, that you're going to take my livelihood from me, it calls for panic. But again, there has to be a way that we can develop an even medium to look at the watermen. And I just read a report that the crab industry has skyrocketed this year. The oyster industry has done better over the previous years. So look at where we are and ask, well, how did you get there? Was it through some ordinances or some change in what you did in order for this increase to occur? Let's look at the farmers. Look at the fertilizers and all those type of preservatives they're putting in the soil. Is that helping you to produce a better crop? Does that impact the water rate? Let me give you an example. At UMES, I went to a school called Somerset, and there's a water rate, Manukin River, that runs in the middle of the campus. In high school, after running cross country, was 2.5 miles, the team used to stop at that river. Now, a little small waterfall. We used to drink that water. Now, you look at it now, I don't think fish even want to swim in that water today. So that tells you that there's a problem. And we've just got to come in with cool heads, control our temper, and not just concern about ourselves, but it's about the entire community. If this group succeeds, this group fails, we haven't accomplished anything. So it's a matter of everybody coming to the table and work for the betterment of every citizen that lives in that county.
By the way, where are you on something like an offshore oil drilling, which I don't think actually necessarily touches where your district is, but nonetheless, it's a part of Worcester County, which is one of the parts that your district represents. Do you think there should be a ban on offshore oil drilling?
Well, I think we need to look at the production of the different fuels that we have, depending on what they're actually looking for and trying to get. But I just don't believe that we need to disturb every part of nature that God has allowed us to enjoy. And again, most of it is fun. It's money driven. It's not that if the resources they show, it's money. If we actually needed resources in order to survive, then you may have to make some decisions. But if it's just for the revenue for different companies, no, I don't think so.
What about wind power? I mean, obviously there's a lot of drive to say have lots of wind power, for instance, on particularly in your district on the Eastern Shore. Where are you on that?
Well, it's natural. It's natural fuel.
You think that's like the thing you want to move forward with?
I think it's natural fuel. If we could find, again, find places that they could put up the solar, the windmills, and that would not disturb the residents, I have no problem with that. I look at the solar industry. I've been riding around the state, looking at, even around the county, looking at different solar farms that they have. Again, if it's not polluting air and it's helping the residents, we can't. I'd be a fool to be opposed to it.
By the way, now, of course, you are a Democrat. I believe you mentioned a moment ago you're chair, actually, of the Democratic Central Committee in Somerset County, it is. What's your view of Governor Larry Hogan, a Republican, who many have said, you know, maybe he's of the opposite party, but boy, he's certainly paying a lot more attention to us than, say, maybe some of the previous Democratic governors. What's your view?
Well, Governor Hogan was well-schooled. His father, I think, was a politician. He had a chance to learn from the youth what politicians actually did. I don't believe that just because I'm a Democrat, I should not concern myself with all the citizenry that I represent. And I think that Governor Hogan is following his suit. He recognizes the need. I mean, if his governor, if Somerset County and other counties continue to go down, that's on his record. He has to leave that. He didn't do anything with Somerset County or Worcester County or Wacomico County. So, again, he has great advisement. He has resources. And he's saying to be, well, I've never met him. But what I've heard, he has a concern for those that have not. And I think that is a point that I like.
Do you think we've benefited from him being governor here on the Eastern Shore?
Well, I'm looking at the few projects that we've had thus far. I must say that we make some strides, but I have a long ways to go.
A long ways to go. So in terms of taxes and that kind of thing, where are you in terms of where you see the budget going for Maryland? We still come up with some shortfalls. I know the Governor Larry Hogan likes to have some tax cuts and cut something from the budget. Where do you see that balance? Are there anything areas that you think we should cut? Are there any particular areas that perhaps maybe a tax increase might be a good thing? What's your sense about that?
Well, historically, politicians have always tried to lobby for more money in their pockets. And I believe politicians are servants. And I do not believe that they should make hundreds of thousands of dollars to be a servant. And I think this is what has happened. But I think we definitely need to channel more money into the educational system. Education and the different parts, facets of the system, that's what's going to change our communities. If you got a young man that drops out, or a young lady that drops out of school in a sixth or seventh grade, look how many resources they're going to drain for these other agencies that are contingent on taxes. So we need to rethink the direction that this state is going. Look at our programs. I've been an educator, again, 40-some years. And I can see the difference that it made with students that I've taught and students that come to the university, students that come to the hospital, even my own children. So we need to challenge more money in education. Again, child care is another I want to bring up. If a family is working, it would cost almost a week's salary to have your child in childcare. So we've got so many unregulated areas that are causing concerns and causing people to work two and three jobs. And again, working those two or three jobs, then all that taxes are taken out. It's an issue. I think we need to go back and look at the entire tax system and see what priority and then go from there.
Now, you're running, obviously, against Charles Otto. He says that he's done a lot for the district, that he's working hard for the people there, points to the carbon monoxide, for instance, detectors and so on. He's been involved with that, as well as obviously advocating for agriculture. I think I saw a quote where you felt like he hadn't done anything at all. Why would you say that he hasn't performed? I mean, because he'll point to a lot of things that he's done.
I'm going to get like Donald Trump. The media has a tendency to twist my words.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
I said that I have not been aware of what he's done because there's no communication of what bills he had been associated with. Carbon monoxide. Let me take care of that first. That was initiated by yours truly. The day that I was told that a family had passed away in the community, I thought the worst. I thought the father had taken the life of his children and committed suicide. So I immediately went to the site of the home, and I talked to the fire marshal, I talked to the sheriff and others, and they told me what had happened. I did not see a politician around. Commissioner Mathias had called me from a distance. Let me know what's happened, and I went there to serve his eyes, Commissioner Mathias, Commissioner District 1, to see what had happened. I went up that night, and I found out that I knew two of the children. We had bought Christmas gifts for them at one time. And my two of my adopted children were in the class with them. And my youngest son said, "Dad, you heard about Trevere." She was the youngest one. And it brought tears to my eyes just to think about what happened, that it could have been preventable. And then visualizing what watching put them kids in a pound of truck like they were logs, you know, like they, you know, that they were not human at all. And I called Commissioner Mathias. I said, "Pastor Mathias, I said, look, that got to be something we can do." I said, so I started investigating. And then from there, I called Commissioner Mathias. I mean, Senator Mathias.
Yeah, Senator Mathias, yeah.
And asked for his direction. And he took it on immediately. He called Demova Power. He set up a meeting with us with Demova Power. We checked and found out why they cut the electricity. It was during the winter month, end of the winter months. It was cold at night. And Arkansas was a father trying to take care of his children, working part-time with seven children, with no other resources. So, again, we looked at the policies from Denver Powell, made some recommendations. Mr. John Allen, the vice president, felt that there needed to be some changes. Sheree Sampa Hughes, a Wacoma County delegate, took up the charge and worked with us along with Senator Mathias. I testified in Annapolis on three occasions, and then we got the state law. So he didn't vote in favor of it.
Yes, he did.
He did vote in favor of it, as well as the county commissioners who supported us, the chief police in Crisfield, Somerset County Sheriff, President and Town Police. All of them wrote letters of support. So I give him credit. He did support it.
Okay. We've been talking with Kirkland Hall. He is running, of course, as a Democrat in the 38A district seat in the Maryland House of Delegates. Appreciate you stopping by, and we'll certainly check in from time to time, see how the election goes.
Well, thanks so much, and please, I announce that we're going to have a Facebook page, Dr. Kirkland Hall, for a delegate, and ask all my supporters to donate generously. That'll be a spot on there for they can donate. So we told Dr. Brother Otto has $12,000 already in his coffer, and I'm starting with zero. So we need some help.
We'll check in with you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Our human ancestors hunted and gathered. They survived and reproduced. And one day, they began to ask why. I'm Krista Tippett. Join me on Being, spacious conversation about meaning, faith, and the immensity of 21st century lives. A journey of discovery from American Public Media.
Sunday morning at 7 on NPR News Talk 90.7 FM, putting Delmarva first.
It's called fake news, and it permeates social media with a vengeance. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The mass shooting at the concert in Las Vegas this past weekend left nearly 60 people dead and just under 500 injured. But there was another casualty, the truth. It is 64-year-old Stephen Paddock, who law enforcement authorities have identified as the shooter. But within hours, far-right bloggers and news sites identified Gary Danley as the shooter, who was described as a left-wing loon. Meanwhile, Mary Lou Danley is considered a person of interest and has been identified as having been married to Geary. And rumors spread that she had been present at the concert and told the audience that they were about to die. She was actually out of the country at the time of the shooting. Finally, commentators on social media insisted there must have been more than one gunman involved in the attack. Take a look at the rise of social media. In our studio this morning is Jennifer Cox, Associate Professor of Communications at Salisbury University, and Jeremy Cox, who is a reporter for the Salisbury Daily Times. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having us.
So let me start with you, Jennifer, taking a look at social media and the spread of all kinds of crazy ideas, and we'll get into some of the politics in a minute. What do you make of that? Is there some way to rein it in? What kind of impact do you think this is having, as opposed to, say, what we had, say, maybe 10 or 20 years ago?
Social media has obviously had a huge impact on society, on the way we communicate, in general, on the way that news gets spread. And fake news isn't a new thing. It's been around as long as news has been around, basically, since the beginning of time. But certainly social media has played a huge role in the pervasiveness of it, how quickly it spreads. The way that I teach my students is that social media, whatever you post on social media, is like toothpaste. If you squeeze it out, you can't put it back in the tube. And that's kind of what we're dealing with here. You know, I've attended a social media conference a couple years ago, and one of the tips that they gave for when you post something incorrectly, as news organizations do, that you shouldn't just delete the tweet or delete the post. What you should do is actually acknowledge it, take a screenshot of it, and then say, this was incorrect, here's the correct info. Acknowledge the breach, so to speak. And that's a better way to kind of add some transparency and to try and spread a message. Because once something's out there, people have seen it. We don't have a Men in Black delete button. And so we have to acknowledge when we make a mistake in the news industry, as we saw a lot of news outlets did with this. And then even with Tom Petty's death this week, we had a similar situation. And so it's the best and only strategy is really to acknowledge it and try to make corrections and try to get the real news out there.
Well, one of the things that struck me is that I was trying to think about the comparison, say, with the early years of the Republic, which you had lots of publications which were not actually newspapers, not we know it, but rather they were owned by political parties or individuals. They spread all kind of scurrilous gossip about each other, including the founding fathers. But you did have a sense about who they were. I mean, where they were coming from. It seems to me with social media, particularly, especially certainly for Twitter, but even Facebook, this stuff gets passed around very quickly, that you're not even sure where it's coming from. I mean, that seems to be one of the big differences.
Yeah, with the one item that comes to mind. But yeah, absolutely about social media. Even with political advertising, newspapers, television, when political organizations advertise there, they have to, you know, say there has to be a tagline, you know, paid for by the committee for to reelect, whatever. And that right now on the internet is not the case. So these ads that you're seeing on Facebook, no one knows where they're coming from. And that, in fact, foreign powers now we're finding are exploiting that loophole with Facebook now turning over. How big was the ad buy?
$100,000. 3,000 ads believed to be linked to Russian election interference.
Yeah. Right. And so the Russians bought some ads on Facebook to try to sow divisions in the black community and drum up anti-Muslim
gun
sentiment.
Control, immigration, racism.
Right. Yeah. In order, right before the election, in several battlegrounds like Michigan and Iowa. And so that's where we're at right now. And, I don't know if Congress will act or Facebook will act, but no one seems to be leading the charge right now.
Well, Facebook is acting. They've recently they're planning some disclosure agreements and things like that. But the bottom line here is that we need to be more savvy news consumers. And Don, you had said, you know, people don't see or, you know, they can't really tell. And it's true. I actually was looking and saw some studies that indicated that people can't tell or don't distinguish between sponsored content or paid content and real news. The same is true with partisan politics. I actually saw posts yesterday about a divisive issue. And I looked at it and I said, I don't know this publication. What is this? And I just did something simple. I Googled it. And it was a completely partisan issue. And so it was only being published in partisan publications, which made me go, I don't know if this is credible or not. So it's actually pretty easy to tell if you just look at the publication, what they stand for. But people just don't take that time. We read headlines, we read tweets, we don't really consider the source, which is a really big problem.
So do you think that we're talking about like the Russians? What do you think this does then to the body politic in terms of massaging it and shifting its views? I mean, I know I'm just about done with Hillary Clinton's book. And one of the things she remarks about is the fact that, as you point out, there were a lot of ads that were bought, particularly in some of the key states she obviously lost, obviously more factors than just that involved in her loss. But that they were able to shape this image of her. She talks about how email was like the most associated word with her name as opposed to, say, Donald Trump. There seems to be something going on in terms of shaping the political mind.
And there's certainly been a lot of division over how big a role social media played in the election. But according to the American People, CNN just released a poll that said 54% of Americans believe Russian interference on social media played a role in Donald Trump winning the election. In the days before the election, there was a study that showed false election stories and hoax sites and hyperpartisan blogs generated more engagement than content from real news in the last 2 to 3 months of the election. And the vast majority of those were pro-Trump, anti-Hillary. And we just saw news come out from Congress yesterday that there was prevalent fake news being passed around via social media in those swing states that did end up winning the election for Donald Trump. So to anyone who says that it wasn't an influential factor, there's too much evidence to suggest that it was.
Yeah, just a cursory, scroll through, Twitter will, show you that it continues to happen. Every day I try to follow about 2,000 people from all walks of life, and, hardly, one screen goes by where there isn't someone posting or reposting something that is jumps out as fake news. But, rings true because, they're maybe hyper-partisan person to begin with, and wow, can you believe this? And then there'll be a link, and no, actually I can't. And I've actually, once in a while, I'll actually jump in there and be, well, no, this is fake news. Here is a screenshot from on the site under the About section. Some of them have taken to actually writing, this is meant for satire only. My favorite is the one, here's what Leonardo DiCaprio has to say about the residents of Salisbury. Wow.
This has been popping up a lot. Yeah.
I didn't know that he cared about us. Or the other one, Miley Cyrus is, you'll never guess why she's buying a house in Annapolis, Maryland. So I look forward to her moving there. I assume that'll work out well. But it's so much easier. The model is so broken, and that it's so much easier. It costs basically no money to post this because obviously you're not doing any reporting, and people are more likely to click on it because you're not bounded by truth. So that going up against something like journalism, which costs a lot of money and is, I'm sorry to say, less interesting than stuff you can just make up a lot of times. It's really an unfair playing field, and trying to get those two matched up again, if not get rid of the fake one, it's going to be incredibly hard from a capitalistic standpoint to take care of.
Yeah, it's absolutely not going to work unless people want it to. I mean, there are emerging tools such as Google Chrome just put out a media bias fact check tool that you can actually put in your browser. There's another one called BS Detector.
I've got one of those.
Yeah, right. But the point is that people have to want to distinguish between fake news and real news. But the bottom line is that most people seek out the news that reaffirms what they already think. So if I am a hyper-partisan person, I'm only going to seek out the news that says, see, this proves my point. And I'm just leading myself down that path. So unless we as informed citizens want the truth, it's going to be way too easy to fool us. And we've seen that on social media.
So what do you make of stories that seem completely outrageous? And the thing that comes to mind, of course, is the attack on the pizza place, in which there was some meme about how that Hillary Clinton was running some kind of child, sexual thing going on, and the guy goes down with a gun. I mean, how is it that, I mean, that seems so beyond the pale that one wouldn't even believe. How is it that people get sucked into believing that? I mean, something so far out of the
audience effects.
Yeah, well, we don't, as consumers of any type of communication, we don't think with our minds, we think with our emotions. And so in that case, there were people that hated Hillary Clinton so much that they wanted to believe those things and wanted to spread that kind of news. And unfortunately, that's, again, not a new thing, but just social media is a tool that just makes spreading that message so much easier, as you said.
Amplifies it.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Pizzagate was, there was even a guy who went and stormed the pizza place and as a vigilante. And, I mean, literally, it's just like a random pizza place, like when you get down to it. And it was a real visceral example, I think, from this last election cycle of how you can weaponize things that are part of the American way of life against us. I think that's really the way you got to think about it.
Yeah, actually, there's reports that now the latest Russian social media invasion has had to do with the NFL debate, the kneeling debate. And they're actually posting things on both sides saying, hashtag kneel together, hashtag stand together. And really, they don't care about the NFL. They're just trying to sow division. And it's working because we are just so eager to seek out anything that says that we're right.
Right. Vladimir Putin's modus operandi this whole time has been, well, America thinks it's so perfect. They sit on their, in their their ivory tower or what have you, and they're not so great. So he doesn't care so much about, specific outcomes, just as long as we make ourselves look bad. And I think
we've succeeded there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but again, weaponizing our institutions against us has proved to be frighteningly easy, and laws and protocol have not kept up with that.
Well, I'm reminded of in the early part of the Republic, and I think it was John Adams, had an issue with the French. And as a matter of fact, the French were influencing whether or not the United States should ally itself with one or another countries in terms of the British and so on. And there you had an outside influence, right, a foreign country doing that. But since then, until this moment, countries have not been all that successful. And now suddenly we've got this open gate. Now, we have the French and the Dutch, for example, who apparently have been able to fend this off. The Germans apparently so. Is there something we learn from them in terms of limiting the influence of this kind of thing?
I'm not a scholar in it, but I have been reading about the latest Russian interference. And there, as we kind of hinted at the outset, it isn't new. The Soviet Union would buy newspaper advertisements and host launder it to have meetings, rallies held in America. And I think that was, again, kind of a precursor of what we see today. But, the modes of media were different back then that kind of kept them from having as wide an impact. I mean, a newspaper might be widely read in a community, but it doesn't have a worldwide reach. Now anybody with an internet connection has a worldwide reach. To either their own URL or through Facebook. So, again, you see this amplifying, this multiplicative effect where these, again, age-old methods and ideas and ways of subverting our government and our dialogue have now found a better route from which to grow.
Yeah, and I can't speak specifically to why or if Europe has been successful, more successful than the U.S., but it could have something to do with the differences in culture. I mean, the U.S. is a very individualistic country. We prize our own personal beliefs over the beliefs of the collective whole. And I don't know that that's as prevalent in Europe, just, again, based on kind of my limited experience with travel and culture there. There does seem to be more of a collectivist attitude in a lot of those European countries that might suggest that there's less of a desire to prove the self right, but more of to do right for the whole or for a greater population.
How much do you think this sort of, I mean, it doesn't really start there, but the birther movement, the idea that the President Obama wasn't born in the country, and that this was a meme that kind of got spread, and obviously Donald Trump made a great deal of it, perhaps his political fortunes on it. And I remember I was talking to my brother who had gotten this email from a friend of his, fairly educated guy, talking about, well, there were all these discrepancies in the email and in the birth certificate. Is that part of the equation, this, or does that represent the shift that's going on in terms of believing what you want and a lot of people just, you know what I mean?
It's certainly frightening how rational people can take issue with things like this, how they don't, how they are so willing to believe something that's blatantly untrue. And I guess part of it, too, is the nature of social media is a kind of a show me medium anyway. I constantly tell my students, you know, don't just tweet, you know, there's a car accident. Take a picture and post that out there. You know, don't just show me that. Don't say it was a bad car accident. Show me a picture of it. Let me make up my mind. And, you know, I don't know that I think when you get to higher levels of security, of national security, you can't just take a picture of the president's birth certificate and send it out via social media. And so I think people are used to, well, if I can't see it, it's not real. Another thing, too, is that we are not very savvy when it comes to manipulated photos and images and videos, which is something that social media has actually been able to help a lot of savvy journalists with. You know, people will send in a photo and say, you know, look at this mass shooting in this area. And then the photographer can or a analyst can take a look at it and say, well, they said this took place at noon, but the sun is clearly in a different spot. There's, mm-hmm. you know, a street corner here that there's a crack on the sidewalk, but this picture doesn't have that crack. And they can really use it to as detectives. But we as average citizens, we don't really have that kind of time or ability.
Yeah, we used to say, and I think this was, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but in political discourse that you're entitled to your own set of opinions, but not your own facts. And the whole idea of fake news by those who created and spread it is to muddy the waters around what are facts. So now that, you know, as when the birther situation that you brought up, even there, well, you're not entitled to your own facts. I have my own facts, or as Kellyanne Conway would call it, alternative facts.
Right. Well, as a matter of fact, and it just strikes me that there is a skepticism now, both on the right and the left, to what is accepted, whether it comes from the government or whether it comes from mainstream media. Now, a lot of it grows out of the disillusionment, certainly of the 1960s, both on the right and the left, obviously with Kennedy assassination and the war in Vietnam and, of course, the Watergate and so on, seems to be the foundation in which distrust of both government and perhaps even mainstream media seems to have occurred. I mean, is this something that just is inherent or has sort of grown inside of the body politic that you're not going to be able to get rid of it? Because it seems to me that a lot of the beliefs and some of the crazy ideas we've been talking about, that's based on the idea that, well, we don't believe, as he points out, we don't believe that what we're being told is true.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. You brought up, I was thinking about this the other day, you brought up Watergate. I wonder how that would play out right now. You know,
it is, in a way.
I mean, it's interesting.
Russiagate.
Yeah, because it's like we're not talking about clandestine meetings in parking garages now. We're talking about, I mean, Would Nixon have been exposed so much sooner thanks to social media, or would he have been able to, or and his PR machine have been able to effectively shut it down or make it a non-issue?
The failing Washington Post.
Yeah, by rallying his supporters. I'd be curious to see how that goes. And you're right. I think we are kind of living in that situation right now.
Yeah. Counterfactual games are fun. But no, Watergate was a high point in America's trust in the media. And, you know, there's been some up and downs, but the overall trend has been, you know, that we distrust our media. You know, I think we're slightly better than Congress, but below pretty much every other institution out there. And I'll be the first to say that we media deserve some of that blame by, you know, things like what we saw the other day with reporting on, you know, Tom Petty's death, where one outlet reports it and everyone piles on instead of doing their own reporting. And then you have fake news spreading. And, you know, and I think you could speak to this, but our objective third person, you know, point of view where we try to write with authority kind of clashes against people's desires, since, especially as you mentioned, since the 1960s, Don, to question authority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually something I've been exploring and I'm in the process of working on a book proposal on, is this idea of journalists becoming kind of part of the story. Trying to break down this barrier of objectivity to say that journalists can literally remove their brains and tell a story completely without bias or without influence is kind of ridiculous. Yeah. And who wants to read that story anyway? Right. I mean, the stories that do well tend to be the ones that have some sort of a component where there's the storyteller has a passion. That doesn't mean that we should lean toward all opinionated writing or getting back to the partisan press or anything like that. But this idea that journalists can emerge in the story, be kind of part of the experience, and then be able to tell a fuller truth, I think that kind of reporting builds trust. It builds transparency. It shows transparency. And it really gives us a more fulfilling experience as an audience to see the reporter kind of really dive in and tell a story in depth. Now, the problem with this, of course, is that newsrooms are shrinking and these things take time. But, you know, I'm optimistic that we're going to get back to some good, that this is a real test for journalism right now, to a real challenge, because this is a problem on the media and it's a problem on its consumers. So the media rushed to tell the story of Tom Petty dying and then not dying and dying. And that went back and forth. And as you said, they got complacent and they cited other organizations saying, hey, it's their fault. It's not ours if we get it wrong. I mean, NPR did that with Gabby Giffords and several followed suit. And so we've seen this happen before. But the fact is there's a premium on being the first and always has been to break news. But the reason that there is that premium is because people are impatient, right? We can't wait for the facts. We can't wait for it to be right.
It's your fault.
Yeah, but I'm saying, you know, until consumers can be patient, or can accept that, you know, we'll get you the story when we have it, the news media are going to keep responding to that need for immediacy. So, it's going to be a constant cycle. And social media makes it that much worse because it is so immediate.
Let me ask you, how much do you think social media has influenced what we consider to be mainstream media? I mean, I've gone to associate press conferences, press conventions where they talk about how, well, okay, we'll follow stuff on social media, some of the old news stations, particularly in Baltimore and Washington. But they said, but we're not going to report until we can, like, make sure that it's right, right? Which is, I guess, the right way to go. But it seems as if there's a lot of stuff that seeps in one fashion or another.
Well, I'm sure you could say this as well, Don, but just the arc of our own careers. When I started as a reporter down with the Naples Daily News in January 2002, you know, my job was to, okay, spend the day reporting a story, even if it was a breaking story, something that we would normally be shouting out, you know, as soon as we learned about it. I reported it, and then at 5 o'clock I turned it in, and I waited until the next morning when it came out. And we did have a website, but it didn't push through until about, you know, minute after midnight. And then about, you know, 2005, we started pushing out more to the internet, which meant that, okay, we would update it there, but we had no way of telling people beyond that, you know, hey, there's this thing that we wrote. And then 2007, 2008, 2009 come along with Twitter and Facebook, and now we have this other method. And now, you know, instead of 5 o'clock being my deadline, literally every minute is a deadline. So I apologize. Some people, you know, watching on the camera can see I'm still checking my phone, like, okay, I got to make sure there's nothing. I mean, you're never off now.
Right.
You talk about change in workflow.
Yeah, it's funny because we worked in the same newsroom, and I remember the days when it was like, don't tell the online people about this story. We don't want to scoop ourselves. Yeah. Literally, we would say, we don't want to scoop ourselves. Which is so dumb now, thinking back.
We fought so hard, like, oh my God, you're going to make me do extra work now? Ugh.
And we would literally hide news from the online people who were just across the newsroom from us, thinking, like, if it went on the web, then TV could get it, and they could get it out before us.
Yeah.
Because we didn't think people were reading the online version.
You wait until 5:05.
Right, right. Yeah, we try to be deceptive with our time. And now it's like, no, you don't wait. You get it out there every minute as soon as you can.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah.
Husband and wife, by the way. I don't know.
That's right.
That, journalism Salisbury power couple.
That's right.
Get that out there.
I'll be sure to remind people that. because this push to get things out, it seems as if it somehow has been so accelerated to the point where it's not that, for instance, well, one of the things that struck me is that. You know, we're talking about fake news and points of view and so on. And one of the things that has struck me is that we may have been reduced to people from one side and then the other side and making various claims, right? I mean, we saw a lot of that, particularly during the presidential campaign, in which I remarked to people that particularly the Trump surrogates, I don't know how many times I saw someone, an anchor, have to say, no, that's not true, right? I've never seen anything quite like that, in which there's this balance, as opposed to talking about reporting, in which you go out, you interview a bunch of people, and you try to figure out what's going on. I mean, we lost something in this idea of, well, we're going to have balance, so we're going to have this person, and maybe we'll correct something that somebody said, but in the end, it's caveat emptor.
Yeah, it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, the Trump supporters will say, well, the media's got it against Trump. And then Trump does a whole bunch of things that either break with norms of the past in the presidency, or does things that are just kind of bad from an optic standpoint, like, you know, throwing
paper towels
at hurricane victims in Puerto Rico. The media says, hey, this is kind of weird, you know, that a president would do this. And then, you know, here it just self-fulfills that whole, oh, there goes the media again, you know, criticizing Trump, you know, they're against him and all this, and bias and whatnot. And it's really, Trump couldn't exist, I think, without that playing field being ready for him to then run out on here in 2016, 2017.
Yeah, the media have certainly become a convenient scapegoat. And we always really have been. I mean, it's always been tough to be a journalist because, you know, you work diligently to represent both sides of a story and to tell the facts, to tell the truth, and then you're still the bad guy. You know, it's like, don't shoot the messenger. But but it always has been that way. And one of the things that I try to teach my students is that, look, you're not getting into this for the money. You're not getting into this business to make friends. You're getting into this business to keep people informed, people who want to be informed, and to make a difference and to help them. To make a difference. And as long as there are still people like that, I don't think that you know, this hyper-partisan prevalence of news is going to live forever. I think that we're still going to see the fundamentals of journalism win out the day at some point. And that we're going to, that if we keep telling these good stories, if we keep telling the truth, if we keep having balance, and then we also keep our mission to fact check, to be the watchdogs of our leaders in society, that eventually, hopefully, people will come around, the people who are going to come around. Another problem with social media is that it's not a great platform for discourse. I don't engage ever. Well, I'm a journalist, so I wouldn't do this anyway, but I never engage in political debate on Facebook or Twitter. It's not an appropriate platform for it. And unfortunately, most of the people who are engaged in these debates are people who are absolutely not going to change their minds anyway. So you have these very visceral, very ugly debates, and people unfriending each other, losing friends. And it's just, it's not worth it. It's not helpful.
Are you willing to die on that hill?
Yeah, it's not going to change anyone's mind. You know, I say this on both sides. I have friends on both sides who will post these things, and I'm like, what are you hoping to accomplish with this? You're not going to change my mind. You're not. It's certainly not in 140 characters. And so it's, until we start having some more of these face-to-face conversations, it's afraid that there's just going to be people who are going to live and die by social media and just looking for what they want to find and posting it. And then hopefully there will be a greater population who will go and actually seek the truth and not engage.
Jeremy, do you share the optimism that the idea that the fake news era, in terms of people not believing and so on, which seems certainly to have been given to a height there with Donald Trump, you think that we're going to phase out of this? Or is this something you think that's going to be part of us for a long time?
I'm heartened that the same mechanisms that led to the problem in the first place are now starting to spin toward a solution here. That this is a country of free dialogue and open discussion. And now you're seeing a conversation, not unlike this one, about what do we do to fix it. It does seem like the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world, this has their attention. He seems to be taking it, if not as seriously as he should be, at least more serious than he did back in last November. And you're seeing some talk on Capitol Hill about what to do about it. And you're seeing, you know, the media talk about it and even some individuals beyond it. Like, you know, I'm tired of being duped. I was searching for one particular example of fake news yesterday. And yeah, on my Google search, it was the number two hit. But the number fourth search return was the one debunking it. And I think that's progress.
Yeah, I was just reminded. I was pulling up the article because I saw this yesterday. Reuters just released a poll that indicates that trust in the media is rising. According to this Reuters poll,
what?
Yeah, I know, right? It's weird.
There you go, Don.
The percentage of adults who said they have a great deal or some confidence in the press rose to 48% in September, up from 39% last November, around the time of the elections. So, hope. Progress, perhaps.
Spring's eternal.
I think you're right. I think people are tired of being duped. I think we're tired of being made to feel like suckers. And I hope that more people take that attitude and approach and start being more cautious. Tuesday was News Engagement Day across the country. And I had posted a couple things about how to detect fake news and how you should look at breaking news and be cautious about it. And overwhelmingly, some of my most popular posts. I mean, people want to know these things. They want these tips.
You're hosting a
I was actually just going to plug our
plug
event. So actually, the three of us, Don, Jeremy, and I, along with a representative from WMDT, are going to be on a fake news panel where we'll be doing workshops, and that'll be at Salisbury University on November 14th. At 6:30, and we're going to be looking at a lot of these issues. And so far, from what we've heard, we're expecting a couple hundred people potentially, because this is something that people want. They not only do they want to hear about this issue, they want to know how to stop it. And so one of the things that we're actually going to be doing is doing computer stickers. And I have a list here of tips for detecting fake news, because people want them and they want them accessible. So you can actually take the sticker, put it on your computer, and have it as a reminder. People want this, and that makes me optimistic.
We're speaking with Jennifer Cox. She's an assistant professor of communications at Salisbury University. Also, Jeremy Cox, who is a reporter for the Salisbury Daily Times, and they are married, as we mentioned a moment ago. We appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
Thanks, Don.
Pleasure.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.